Guys, welcome to another episode of the Breaking Down Current Affairs of the World podcast. For the past 1 week, we've been monitoring the situation which has been existing in the Middle East, especially in the Gaza Strip, with Israel carrying out airstrikes and Hamas carrying out rocket attacks against Israel. At the same time, we've decided that, you know, in order to cover this part, we thought of bringing on Vedant Mishra. Vedant Mishra is someone who has come over our podcast a number of times. He's someone who specializes in the Middle East as well. And, you know, we decided to come down in a conversation with him, not only regarding this very crisis prevailing right now, as well as number of updates regarding the fact that Saudi Arabia and Iran are looking forward to better relations between both of them, even a possible this could be a starting point for even possible negotiations in the Yemeni civil war, even certain updates regarding the Syrian presidential elections, the constitutional committee's workings, and also as well as the various updates regarding the leaked tape of the foreign minister, with Iran foreign minister, which could what it could mean for Iran foreign policy as a whole. So we talked about regarding all of this, and we got this interview recorded, and we hope that you enjoy it. At the same time, we have just uploaded about a new blog post on the blog site. I'll put it in the description, the link, and it is a blog post on Yemen. We've made it a point to describe everything which is happening in Yemen, all the parties involved. We've even tried evaluating different peace processes that are taking place in the region, even given number of analyst views. I'm going to be putting the blog link in the description, so check it out and listen to the interview, and I hope you like it.
Right.
Hi, Vedan.
Hi.
To have you here once again. Yeah. And, you know, we'll obviously in this episode, we're discussing primarily the Middle East. And considering the Gaza Strip issue is, you know, extremely vast, we'll be covering it a bit later. So, you know, coming first to Syria, and especially the Syrian presidential elections. So, the opposition has been calling it a farce. The U.S. is not willing to recognize the outcome of the elections under its U.N. observer. And all of Syrian society participate. Now, you know, considering that the Syrian presidential election 2014 were held primarily in government-controlled areas, do you think this will be any different?
Yeah, so see, firstly, when we talk about the Syrian elections, it's like, you know, North Korea having elections and saying that it was democratic in nature, okay? So we need to understand the fact that, even in 2014 elections, the fact lies that, you know, there were more number of votes were received by Assad's party than there were number of eligible voters. Like, for example, if the Assad party got 200 votes, the number of voters were 100. I don't know how these 100 voters came about. Okay. Secondly, in a way, also we can say that, you know, the Syrian constitution has been amended and everything. Assad, like, increases number of terms, there was a referendum, whatever. But see, understandably, these elections essentially doesn't hold any value because you already know the results. We know that Assad will win, or even if, let's say, Assad doesn't win, someone of his mindset would take power. Because, again, Assad does not want to lose power because the civil war essentially hasn't ended yet. Okay. And also, as we have seen SNC's statement on the same, they have clearly said that his election will be free and fair when the war criminal Assad is not taking part. And as far as France and US goes, they have also made it amply clear that these elections aren't free and fair in nature, so we won't recognize the same. So I think this sums up everything.
So, like, you know, considering the fact that, you know, media reports are pointing to, you know, Russia, Iran, and China being among some of the election observers in this particular election in Syria, do you think that, you know, these countries, they're primarily dictatorships, so do you think that these observing this kind of an election of someone like Assad, will it create any kind of difference?
See, like, I was in a MUN, and this delegate of USA, he made an extremely well point. He said that what's the whole point of Astana agreement when, like, you know, when your allies as such, they are a part of it. Means essentially, there is no opposition. There is no opposition who can help in framing of such a peace work. Whereas we have Iran, Russia, and Syria, who have the same motives, who have the same agenda. That is, let's say, destruction of the non-state actors, violent non-state actors. So see, having these observers is just in a way to say that, okay, we are here. We are here. And understandably, we are here, and understandably, you can't say that you know, these elections aren't free and fair. These elections don't hold any value. They do. We took a vote. We took a note of it. These are the statistics. These are the facts, etc., etc. Again, it's the same as saying that North Korea is having elections and China is the observer.
Right, because you know, obviously North Korea has like only one candidate, Kim Jong-un, and like there's no one else, and the people have to just vote for him or else you're dead. That's like how it is in North Korea almost.
Yeah, it is, and in a way, if you look at the statistics, even Kim Jong-un can contest and say that, okay, see, I have an opposition leader who can't say that it's a one-party system. Exactly. Same was for Syria. I mean, if you look at the opposition party, there is a female presidential candidate, but it does not hold any. You, if it isn't free and fair. In 2014, Assad had proved this fact. It had proved it. I mean, how can a party get more votes than there are more eligible voters in Syria? How? It shows exactly. The election was corrupted. It was rigged.
Right. So basically, you know, you spoke about the Astana peace process, you know, that it's not being able to contribute much to the Syrian peace process as a whole. So now that is the Astana format has expressed support for the workings of the Constitutional Committee. But the number of reports are now pointing that number of clauses which are being proposed by the Constitutional Committee, none of them are being accepted by the Syrian government. It's delayed the working a lot. I mean, UNSC Resolution 2254 was passed, like, I think 2015, right? And it's been six years ever since. So even now, the committee hasn't been able to bring up a draft constitution or even a couple of clauses to begin with. So, like, do you see these negotiations going any forward, considering the elections are just about less than 2 weeks away?
See, firstly, you need to understand that no person, entity in this world would like to give up power willingly. Even if they give up power, they would give up power in such a way that they are technically in power, but at ipso facto, they are not. Right? So, right. Yeah. You know, first of all, we need to understand the fact that, basically says that president cannot run for let's say, 4 terms. Okay. And if the president has ran earlier, they cannot run again. You get my point, right? Like any clause that debars Assad from running again. Okay, so it would not be accepted, right? They would clearly say that no, we cannot accept it. And it's, in a way, it's not safe. It's safe to say that this Constitutional Committee is just a farce. It's just a farce for Russia, Iran, and Syria to show. Okay, see, we are working. Okay, we want a constitution. We want the goodwill of the people. But it's just a farce. At the end of the day. It is business as usual for them. So that's that. So let's see what happens.
Yeah, so you have made an important point about the powers over there not working towards the peace process, not working towards a people-based approach, right? And but right now, you know, in the Middle East, if you look at it from a broader point of view, the Saudi Arabia-Iran relations might be coming to a much warmer stance because when you look at both countries having expressed a desire to work together to even establish relations and have much better relations both with each other. And you know, this soft approach of Tehran towards Riyadh comes at a time when Riyadh has offered the Houthi rebels in Yemen a ceasefire agreement. So do you think that, you know, number of UN panel of experts, reports, they point to Iranian military support to the Houthi rebels. So do you think that this normalizing of relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia can help in contributing to the Yemeni peace process?
Okay, so firstly, I'm not the kind of a person who believes in media reports and conspiracies and very good chance that, maybe Tehran and Riyadh, they are actually planning to normalize relations. But one of the fact, another key fact being, surely if Iran and Saudi Arabia normalize relations, it would be a humongous achievement for Middle East and for peace in the region as such. Okay, they can collaborate and everything. But again, it depends upon what they make, like, you know, under what context are they making peace in the context of Yemen, or are they making peace in the context of let's say, like, you know, having a unified stance against Israel or whatever that be. So understanding that if that happens, that is a test of time. We need to wait. Okay, secondly, coming to the UN panel's report point, to also understand the fact that, you know, most of the, like, whenever if you talk about a report that alleges that okay, this country has sent out weapons to this particular non-state entity. This again in turn creates a major problem because it is contested by the state with their facts. So when the Secretary General report had been released, which simply said that the weapons are Iranian made. Okay, the weapons are Iranian made. Iran contested the facts by saying the Secretary General's investigative mechanisms, he did not have the mandate to do so. Okay, there were a lot of factual inaccuracies in the report, whatever, etc., etc. So this panel of experts report, keeping in mind that sometimes they're held by the states as account, as liable reports, sometimes they are not. In most of the cases, they are not. Okay. So, okay, there is a panel of experts report which says the same. We could use the facts and figures and ask the country the question the same, but they will contest with the facts. So, establishing a proper, good, liable link between a state and a non-state entity, it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of time and it is virtually impossible to do so.
Yeah, so you made a good point about, these panel of experts report, they may be used to hold a country accountable or may not be used. Iran has its own support in the UN Security Council because when it came to a resolution on Yemen, the UK basically drafted this resolution which mentioned Iran's violation of the arms embargo imposed and Russia just vetoed it. Because Russia and Iran have their own strategic relations. So that shows that, Moscow doesn't want this to pass. And so Iran may or may not even need to pay attention to this UN panel of experts report at all.
Yep. So as I said, UN panel of experts report is not, it is not technically always held like a legitimate source. Okay. Now, important fact being here that whenever this Iran Syria axis, okay, if you try to put allegations, if you try to establish a fact through be it a binding or a non-binding UNSC resolution on that particular state, right, there is a good chance that, because again Russia has their own strategic interests in the region and they don't want that to be hampered, okay, and that arms embargo, it could also be taken in the context of the sanctions or in the context of, let's say, JCPOA per se. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. In the context of JCPOA per se. And we know Russia's stance on JCPOA. And also this, if there was a link established between Iran and Houthis, right? Then we come to state responsibility. Okay. If there is a link established between them, then we come to state responsibility. And there are two kinds of state responsibility that we can broadly define as such. Joint criminal liability, then is vicarious responsibility, and then we have absolute responsibility. So joint criminal liability basically said that the state and non-state, and vicarious in a way it says that the state paid some money or paid weapons or to anything that they did, and then the non-state entity caused harm, whatever. But if such a link is established, then no one can save Iran from state responsibility. And if state responsibility is brought about, then a number of convention comes into play and then it's a legal pickle for Iran. But of course, sure, it has Russia's support. But if state responsibility is established, it's not good news for Iran in general.
Yeah, on a legal basis of sorts.
Yeah, legal basis.
So, you spoke about the Iran-Syria axis, and that brings me to the recent audio tape of Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif, which was leaked regarding the IRGC setting Iranian policy. One thing he stated was that he had number of conflicts with General Qasem Soleimani, who was the head of the Quds Force, the foreign wing of the IRGC as sorts. And, there was basically this conflict regarding Iranian policy in Syria, because Iran supports the Hezbollah, which is fighting on behalf of the Assad regime. And, these policies that support the Assad regime, but these could damage Iran's long-term interests. You see the sanctions policy the U.S. has imposed, the Caesar Act, which has damaged Iran's economy to a great extent. And so, regarding this very conflict, do you think that this compromises the way the Astana peace process works? Because after all, Iran is also part of the Astana format.
Audio tape leak, okay. And like, understandably, we need to understand a very key factor here, and that fact being that it's a very sad fact, but the flat fact being that the legitimacy of this audio tape could be contested. So John Kerry has said that, okay, I was not here. Okay, but there, like, you know, I think there's I don't follow United Nations, sorry, US domestic politics in general, but there have been some cynic, no, let's say motions per se that are being kind of pushed by the Republicans. Okay, now in Iran as such, the reaction from the supreme leader, it was pretty clear. It was he was shocked, he was disheartened. He said that how could an official do this. He said this indirectly, but we got the context. And firstly, he said that, you know, IRGC controls most of the policy. Being in Syria is not beneficial for us. Being in, like, you know, also they mocked Israel, if I'm not wrong. These are the three takeaways. So now, key pointer being that, like, you know, will this harm the Astana peace process on a public image? No. Privately, it could definitely harm the Astana peace process. One can question Iran's legitimacy for talking to right? Or, like, you know, let's say laughing with them, or like, you know, one could question the foreign minister. Another thing that could happen was that, you know, Javed Zarif is asked to resign. He's asked to resign, a new foreign minister comes in place, or he's penalized for the same, right? As far as US goes, they would contest on legitimacy, but what happens back door? What backdoor diplomacy, what happens backdoor anywhere, it is not really known by anyone. So, yeah, let's see what happens regarding the audio tapes.
Earlier we spoke about the JCPO and possibly Russia's stance. Now, the audio tape, which actually was leaked, you know, he didn't mention the Moscow's role in destroying prospects of the JCPOA or the Iran nuclear deal. And because, you know, the JCPOA was like a first step towards these normalizing relations between the West and Iran in some form or the other, right? So, you know, the JCPOA, the Russia did not want that. And so, Qasem Soleimani seems flew to Moscow to ensure that they could have these prospects. So do you think, you know, this actually, what does this mean for, you know, Russia's role in the current negotiation taking place, with Vienna talks taking place right now to the intermediaries? What does this mean for Russia?
I really did not, like, could you just reframe a question, like, what's the, are you trying to establish a relation between JCPOA and Astana? I could not understand the question.
No. Basically, the point is that, you know, Russia has been trying to prevent JCPOA taking place, at least privately, that's what the audio tape says.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So now we are looking at current Vienna talks taking place between certain intermediaries, so that the US and Iran can come to a consensus regarding a particular nuclear deal, another nuclear deal of sorts. And so, do you think this affects the credibility of Iran or even Russia if it is a part of the negotiations?
See, if it, of course, it also affects the credibility of US. I mean, see, US are essentially mocked and important ally to them. Also, in a way, like, you know, US also, let's say, laughed, like, you know, at the back doors. One of the government officials laughed at Javed Zarif on particular stances. Javed Zarif also mentioned about Qasem Soleimani and, like, you know, the religious factors in Syria, the religious factors that come into play in Syria. Understandably, again, as I said earlier, what happens backdoor, does it harm the credibility? Of course it does. But what happens publicly, right? What happens publicly, what happens when these type of leaks happen? The states simply say that these have no legal validity, these have no legitimacy as such. So publicly, whatever we are seeing, whatever show that we are seeing, that will continue. But what happens backdoor, right? What happens backdoor when US comes along and they question Iran? Or, like, you know, let's say Russia comes along and questions Iran that how did we sabotage the deal? Okay, why did, like, also, I don't think that the tapes mentioned the ulterior motive of Moscow's to sabotage the deal. If they did, please let me know. But if it has not, then again, these are the questions that why would Moscow want to sabotage the deal? Because, again, as far as the, like, you know, as far as whatever publicly, what is available publicly on the internet, whatever statements that they have made, it is pretty evident that they support, they're against US backing out of the JCPOA. They are, like, they have, like, you know, their hands tied with Iran. It's like, okay, we are brothers. We will fight US oppression, whatever that being. So, key factor being, if Moscow tried to do this, then why? I think this why would be definitely, researched by the academics. So, let's see.
Right. So now let's come to the most important issue that has been taking place in the Middle East for the past 1 week. That is the violence in East Jerusalem as well as the Gaza Strip. So just to recap of sorts, so last week Israeli police stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque and fired rubber bullets, grenades, and tear gas at Palestinians, which resulted in more than 300 of them getting wounded. And following the expiration of an ultimatum given by Hamas demanding Israel to stand down forces from the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, the Hamas fired several rockets at Israel. Now, you know that people are continuously saying, even countries have been saying that Israel has a right to self-defense. And you know, again, the charter in the UN charter under Article 51, right to self-defense is mentioned. And the Israelis have struck Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. But even after that, it continues air raids relentlessly. So do you think that the Israeli response to the current situation, is it justified? Is it response really justified?
Okay, so that's a very broad question, so I'll answer it one by one. Firstly, the recap again, Al-Aqsa Mosque raiding, evictions in Sheikh Jarrah, that is there. Important point being, when we talk about self-defense, right, there are three things that go hand in, one thing in particular that goes hand in hand, that is the concept of proportionality. Okay, proportionality is extremely important because I think during my po like, in political science also, proportionality is extremely important because you, if someone pinches you, don't hang that person. Okay, if someone let's say shoots you in the leg, okay, again, he has harmed you, you have the right to self-defense, but that if that person shoots you in the leg, that doesn't mean that you shoot in the heart. Okay, you either try to be like, try to save, like,
Disarm
disarm him, or if you like, if you cannot disarm him, like, or you try to run away, whatever. It's a very wrong example, person, not a correct example. But the best
yeah.
example that I gave earlier, that would be if someone pinches you, don't hang them. Okay.
Right.
Now the point being, in 2006, when Israel carried out their they carried out their bombings in the Gaza Strip, there's a national consensus that Israel had used excessive force. So one key factor being that one simply cannot use excessive force. Why does proportionality exist in the first place? To maintain international peace and order. Okay. Second
Right.
thing, that is the Carolin doctrine, okay, or the doctrine of necessity. Is it necessary for Israel to bomb Gaza Strip? Does, like, if Israel has been for the rockets, so is it necessary for them? That's also a good question that one can pose to Israel. Okay. So necessity and proportionality, and most importantly, distinction. Okay. So under the IHL, it is very well defined as such that, one can attack, let's say, schools, hospitals, etc., etc., if they feel that these are being used by the military. Not feel, if this it is proved that it's being used by the militants. One major loophole that comes into play here, who will prove the same? If we see in the case of in the Syrian war, when Russia goes on and bombs schools and hospitals, under IHL, they can simply say that this was used by terrorist organizations, and they can contest it, and they can contest it with their facts. Same case goes for Israel, and they are exactly doing this. They are precisely doing the same. So it's a extremely worrying situation. B, is Israel's response proportionate? Is Israel's response necessary? Is it following the principle of distinction? That is again contested by facts and figures. That is again contested by facts and figures. Israel in 2006, they had released a paper which said that they had proved, like, whatever international lawyers said, that is not factually correct, and they had actually completed the test of proportionality. So that's that. So let's see, like, it's again, it is based on facts, and when two parties have facts, right, when two parties have facts, there is nothing much you can do. Two parties have facts, and, like, and they are both fighting amongst each other. Point being that, will Israel be held liable? Should Israel be held liable? That's a very what should I say? That's a very important
Important
question,
point.
yeah, that the international community should focus upon. And could you just repeat the second part of the question?
Yeah, like obviously another question which comes out of this is, you know, countries have not yet now recognized a Palestinian right to self-defense and or even a Palestinian state as a whole. Like people have the right to self-determination, Do you think that there is a Palestine can itself be a state, or it can at least have a right to self-determination and a right to self-defense after these Israeli attacks?
See, in a way, if we see that, like, Palestine technically it is not a state yet. Okay, it is not a state.
Right, exactly.
There is PLO, but is it a state or not? I don't think so. Technically, it's still not a state. They have some areas they have under their control. Even I think during one of, like, for the vaccination thingy, the Israeli Supreme Court ruled that, Palestine has their own jurisdiction. They need to focus upon the civilians. Israel government, it is not responsible of the Israeli government. And the Palestinians also accepted this judgment. But when it comes to self-defense, again, that's a good question. But we have to understand the fact that is Palestine a state? And for self-determination, of course, they have the inalienable right for self-determination. Okay, so if a Israeli supporter says that the Jews invoked the right to self-determination, then the same goes for Palestine, because Palestine self-determination, it has been recognized by the international community. And also, Palestine has all the attributes for a state: a defined border, able to carry out diplomatic, the ability to carry out diplomatic
Diplomatic
missions,
relations,
yeah,
right?
diplomatic relations, diplomatic missions, whatever that being, a defined population. It is, they have all the attributes for a state. But in order to exercise their right effectively, Israel needs to back off. Israel needs to stop the settlement policy. Israel needs to, what should I say? Stop with its, evictions. And, a better word for settlement policy would be social engineering. Social engineering, or in a way, we can say Israel is trying to change the status quo of Jerusalem. It is trying to change the status quo of West Bank. And when that is happening, right, it's a extremely worrying situation. And in a way, that is a violation of Article 49 clauses of the Fourth Geneva Convention. That be transfer of population, that be social engineering, it is very comprehensively covered in Article 49 Clause 6. And Article 49 Clause 6, coupled with additional protocol of the Geneva Convention, that is Article 85. Point to be noted here: additional protocol, Article 85 is the international customary law. It has ripened into international customary law. That's a grave breach of international customary law. It is a grave breach of international law. But again, a state may continue with these breaches of international law. How can one hold the state responsible? That's the question that the international community has to deliberate upon. It is so important right now in the Israel-Palestinian conflict that, okay, Israel violated international law. Okay, Israel, the Israeli interpretation of the law is not accepted. So what should we do with Israel? What should we do? Should Israel pay reparations as given out in the Corfu Channel case? Like, if the state breaches international law, for all the materialistic damages, they need to pay reparations. Should Israel do that? Or should we follow PCIJ judgment? It's a very comprehensive debate that the national community needs to carry out.
Right, so you make a very important point there about accountability, which is required. Like one thing though, you mentioned about the various ways in which Palestine does have a right to self-determination. Just to clarify, these do fall under Article 1 of the Montreal Convention, right?
So see, Montevideo, in a way, declarative theory is covered by the Montevideo Convention, and the declarative theory is basically about recognition. Okay, so Palestinians have the right to self-determination because they possess all the attributes for a state. And it's not as, see, in constitutive theory, it's basically given that other states recognize that, okay, this area, this, that, that this is a state, but that the same, but it has inherent defects. But for declarative theory, right, it is essentially given out very comprehensively that a state can exist without having the, like, the obligation recognition from other states. A state can.
Right. That's right. And another point which has been which needs to be brought out is the current US government's policy. So like just to give a slight insight, US government did not want any UNSC meeting on the conflict. I think the UN and even all 40 members of the UNSC were ready to provide a joint statement on on asking Israel to de-escalate and to completely, prevent all these attacks from taking place, and the US did not allow the statement to go through. So, in past administrations, the Trump administration engaged Arab countries to work with Israel to the Abraham Accords. It took, frankly, according to me, it took a very undiplomatic move by recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital. And before that, the Obama administration had abstained from a UNSC resolution 2334, which significantly called Israel settlements illegal. So, do you see right now at this Biden administration policy, is the Biden administration by any chance carrying out any of the previous administration's policies, or is it even putting forward a multilateralism policy at the center of the Israel-Palestine conflict?
So, okay, again, a very multifaceted question. So, in a way, we need to understand two to three key factors here. Okay, one key factor being important key factor being that being that like you know Biden is the let's say like you know the most the most common American president that we have. It like you know Biden may do blunders domestically, but internationally the fo his foreign policy is basically shaped my experiences being under Obama. Okay, it's still safe to say that, and also under being the like you know under Senate's Foreign Relations Committee. Now, understandably, we need to understand the fact that Biden, when Biden says that Israel has a right to self-defense, they are saying so because it has been said so by the previous Obama administration also. Biden essentially, they are not forming an alliance with Israel. Okay, they're not forming an alliance like Obama had condemned the illegal settlements. Same goes for Biden. I am certain on this fact that Biden will condemn Israeli settlements when it comes to this fact. And as far as UNSC meeting, I think even US agreed for a SC meeting on this issue because it was a very boiling issue. And I think if I'm not wrong, if I could be wrong, I don't remember the state in particular, but some I think Tunisia had requested for the same. Tunisia had requested for the same for such a meeting.
China as
And
well.
yeah, China as well. So even they like you know they're carrying out the meeting and there would be a public meeting held. There would be a public meeting held soon. So yeah, let's see. And also India's stance on the same. So yeah.
Right, thank you so much, Pitan. We'll just cut off a short break. So, we'll see you later, okay?
Okay, yeah, thanks.
Thank you so much back from the break. And there's so now where I wanted to bring up this UNSC resolutions, whether they're legally binding or not, because last week we had this conversation regarding that. And you made an important point that although Article 25 of the UN Charter does in fact perhaps imply that these resolutions are legally binding, there is an ICJ decision or an advisory opinion on Namibia versus South Africa case, which would say otherwise. So I was able to go through the judgment and certain other articles, summarize some of the judgment points. And if you look at the clarification made was that interpreting a resolution would require understanding the intent of the body, which can be gathered from three factors: language used in a resolution, discussions leading to the adoption of a resolution, and the charter provisions invoked. So, if you look at the resolution operative clauses, which were given affirmative by the ICJ advisory opinion, then compare them with UNSC Resolution 2334 regarding illegal Israeli settlements, there have been words like decides, declare, calls, and calls upon, which have been used in paragraphs 5, 6, 7, and 8 of Resolution 2334. So, then after that, if you look at prior discussions, you look at the preamble of Resolution 2334, which clearly gives number of other resolutions at 242, 238, 246, etc. And reference to charter provisions, if you look at it, the 233 does not make 2334 does not make any direct reference to charter provision, but it is guided by the principles of the UN Charter, and the preamble is guided by the principles of the UN Charter. So, even another important factor which is not mentioned in the judgment, I was reading a Wire article on this, and it mentioned that there was not just these three factors, but one fourth factor which is not mentioned in the Namibia judgment was a call for all parties to distinguish between the pre and post 1967 territories in relevant dealings with Israel, which amount to an international call to action based on a resolution. So, considering all of these factors combined, Do you think that UNSC Resolution 2334 is a legally binding resolution?
To player, as you said, in ICE, like, you know, in Namibia versus South Africa case, where the ICJ gave this advisory opinion that it is determined by the language, especially, and it is based on a case by case basis. So, essentially, it is really in not in my legal competence to comment upon whether 2234 is binding in nature, right? There are many people who consider the fact that calls upon is essentially not legally binding, and many people who feel the opposite, right? And also, essentially, even if you leave about 2234, international consensus is upon the fact that there are a lot of UNSC resolutions that are legally binding upon Israel, and Israel has been violating it. I mean, there was this, there was this article, and basically said that Israel is the only con is only is the only state, essentially, that has violated around 165 of UNSC resolutions. So again, are these resolutions binding or not? Essentially, these are heavily, laid on the fact that whether they are again highly laid on the fact that what language has been used and is it binding on a case by case basis.
Right. So now let's come to, you know, an important part, which was the Abraham Accords. And that is, you know, do you consider that the Abraham Accords can play a role in ensuring a proper peace process is followed here? Because, you know, you have countries like the UAE and Jordan, which have called upon Israel and have called out their military action. And, you know, at the same time, they have just normalized relations with Israel. So do you think that and using the Abraham Accords, can the Abraham Accords be used to facilitate a peace process between the parties?
Of course, essentially, in a way, it established, if I'm not wrong, established a few economic and trade relations, and also it, recognition is a very important part. Okay. So, can Abraham Accord, in a way, to make, I mean, see, this again,
Again, plays back to the fact
that recognition does not equate from immunity from criticism. Okay, that's essentially saying the fact that okay, India recognizes Pakistan, India shouldn't criticize Pakistan. No, bad example. But let's say if we if we say in the state of Israel, that's when the Turkey was the first Islamic nation to recognize Israel. Okay, and Erdogan came along and he said that okay, it is the terrorist state of Israel. There are trade economic relations that may cause a strain in the relations, but it does not stop them. A strain is caused. So importance should be given here, more level should be given to recognition. Okay, recognition, because again it was a recognition that was not de facto, it was de jure in recognition. So essentially, can this be used to make peace again? Israel's whole point, it is not with the Arab in this conflict, in the recent conflict, it is not with the Arabic nations. Okay, it is not with the Arabic nations around them. The Arabic nations have condemned Israel, they have not taken arms against them. Israel's conflict being with Hamas, their conflict being with Hamas, their conflict being with Hamas, it's a radical political entity that entails the fact that okay, we should be destruction of Israel is in is one of our agendas.
Right.
Yeah, when we talk about Hamas, now most of the countries have declared them as a terrorist organization. So it's extremely hard for them to, to be even brought in the negotiating table. Can we initiate the quartet here? Absolutely not, because most of the quartet have declared Hamas to be a terrorist organization. So how can we bring Hamas to the negotiating table? That is also a very difficult case. In a hypothetical scenario, if you say that Hamas comes to the negotiating table. Another problem that we will see, the Palestinian Authority will go back to I think 2006 politics. They have to make sure that whether Hamas is a legitimate is a legitimate entity,
Representative.
is a legitimate entity or representative of the Palestinian people. So I know it's a very complex question to be answered. So yeah.
Right. So, you know, considering you brought Hamas into question, another thing is that Hamas has been using, at least reportedly, they have been using Iranian-made drones or drones of Iranian origin. So, how much of a role do you think that Iran plays here? Considering, you know, Iran and Israel already have number of problems in relations regarding Israel's assassination of top Iranian nuclear scientist, or even a recent attack on the Natanz nuclear site. Do you think this could possibly be the revenge which Iran has always vowed upon Israel?
See, essentially, if you talk about Iran and Israel, first of all, personally, I feel that Iran is just a pawn for Israel. I mean, if you talk about the nuclear sites, okay, Benjamin Netanyahu going to the UNG and saying these are the secret nuclear facilities. Okay, so if these are the secret nuclear facilities, one person needs to understand that these, like, Iran has a very extensive IAEA check. Okay, it has the most IAEA reports on it. Okay. Why hasn't
Right.
Israel? Why doesn't the international community know much about Israel's quote unquote secret nuclear facilities? Because it does not even allow IAEA to enter. Does not. It is secret in nature because Israel says no, we cannot allow them. Iran is just a pawn for Israel to divert the national community from the Israeli atrocities. Okay. Now, understandably, if we talk about Iran funding Hamas, first of all, Iranian-made weapons. Then Iran can contest it with the facts that okay, we have embargo upon us, that it but it is it but it isn't essentially necessary. If it is Iranian-made weapons per se, right? They can say that oh, maybe we sold these weapons before the embargo. Just an example, we sold these weapons before the embargo. Any state could give Hamas the weapons. Okay, being like, just it being made in Iran does not essentially mean that Iran is responsible because Iran may contest it with their facts. If they are saying that it is Iranian made, Iran would say no, it is not Iranian made. You're saying it wrong. Most importantly, so as far as Iran's one of top agenda being destruction of Israel, that is also true. I cannot deny
Yeah,
that.
true.
Like but no, in a way, Iran can say this in the national community. But I mean, we all know it's an open secret. Iran does fund proxies to for their own benefits. They do fund Hamas. They do fund Houthis. So it's not a big issue.
Right. So, coming to another piece of conflict that's taking place in East Jerusalem, you find the far right Israelis forming militias to attack Arabs who are living in Israel, or even Israeli Arabs themselves. And they have been chanting slogans of death against them. So, do you think this amount of polarization in Israel has been a result of Netanyahu's continuous policies towards Iran and Palestine?
Could you just repeat the chanting part?
And they've been chanting slogans of death against these against the Arab against Israeli Arabs.
See, in a way, if we look at Israeli politics in the first place, it is very safe to say that, not all the Israelis sanction, or not all the Israeli feel that whatever Netanyahu is doing, whatever his name is, I'll just call him Benjamin. Whatever Benjamin is doing, it's correct per se. Some far, people who endorse Benjamin Netanyahu's party, they do feel that okay, whatever they are doing, it is correct in nature. The settlers are heavily armed settlers who are going along, who are continuing the settlements, evictions, etc., etc., etc. Whatever that be. Okay, now most important key factor being that we need to understand that the Israeli politics right now is it is being dominated by a very small minority. It is being dominated by a very small minority, and Benjamin Netanyahu has been losing the confidence of the Israeli voters. So that's why we can see a coalition right now in the first place. So again, so let's see what happens here. And as far as the settlers goes, yeah, even that's wrong. Okay, see, in this context, I would like to bring up another point, and that being that one of the key factors that most of Israeli supporters, they say that the Jews were oppressed for a very long time, which is not wrong. They were oppressed for a very long time. The Jews faced Holocaust, which is also not wrong. They did face the Holocaust. They were persecuted mercilessly. But does this sanction Israel to flout international law? Does this sanction Israel to pass such apartheid laws? To pass such apartheid laws against the Palestinians? Does this sanction Israel to carry out, sorry, to fire rubber bullets upon peaceful Ramadan, when on peaceful Ramadan, people who were praying in Ramadan, and Israel fired rubber bullets, Israeli forces? It does not. One cannot use one suffering to justify oppression of another community. It clearly does not. And that is a fact here. See, the point being, when someone keeps Holocaust in front of you, right? You cannot, okay, one can also deny Holocaust. I'm not saying that.
There are people who do that actually.
Yeah, who do deny Holocaust. It never happened. But being a sensible person, they don't deny Holocaust. So this in turn actually gives them the immunity to carry out their work. And this is actually more problematic. Some people, I think I've seen a lot of people who criticize Israel to be tagged as Nazis. Are they Nazis? They're not. Is the Israeli Prime Minister who made peace with, who made peace with Palestine, he was executed. He was shot. Why? Because on both the sides, or being the Arabs or be the Palestinians, we see that there are people who do not want peace in the first place, who do not want peace. And when that's a situation, right, that's an extremely worrying situation. Solutions, a two-state solution is the only solution that we can endorse. When these two entities coexist together peacefully, that's the only solution we can endorse. Annihilation is not a solution. One-state solution is not a solution, because if we go by one-state solution, there would be even more violence. So, yeah.
You know, you made a really good point regarding the fact that there is narrative building which has been happening. You know, that Israel, we understand, Israel has been persecuted for a long time. I mean, Israel...
Jews.
Thanks for getting me there. So Jews, the Holocaust, we know about that, as well as, Israel and the Arab wars. So, this narrative building has resulted in people painting this image that Israel or so the only people who are being persecuted entire time, and there is nothing on their part, which is actually not the on the ground situation, and that is not the fact, right? Because
exactly.
Because at this particular point, it's carrying out apartheid policies, and again, a good point. Two-state solution is the only means, because you can't have any one. All the sides need to come to the table, and there has to be a two-state solution on the 1987 borders, which is the most important part right now. And to end this, I just give you one last question. It is, at this particular point, Hamas has proposed a ceasefire. Israel has rejected it. Countries continue to support Israel's right to self-defense as it bombs different buildings. It even today bombed a media building belonging to the president of Al Jazeera. And there are reports that the IDF is planning a ground invasion. And then you find Palestinian forces in Lebanon and Syria, they are all attacking Israel as well. So do you see a third intifada on the rise at this point?
Okay. Third intifada, very much plausible, but it is also plausible that the situation cools down. Regarding the tunnels as such, there has been a new development on the same. Where the IDF has been claiming that we spread this narrative of ground invasion so that Hamas could use the tunnels and then we could bomb these tunnels. Okay, as far as the bombing of the journalist building goes, extremely worrying. I have to check the facts and I have to read more about it. Another key fact being Hamas proposing a ceasefire. I think recently Hamas also flouted. They boasted about their new intermediary long-range missile that could annihilate Israel. See, if Hamas is willing for a ceasefire, Israel right now, see, in a way, isn't it also safe to say that it is one of, we also know that there are corruption charges against Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yeah, so, right.
Yeah, there are corruption charges against him. So, it's also very safe to say that he's trying to divert the public attention towards this. He's trying to divert the public attention towards this. He's trying to show that he's the only real power of the Israeli people. He can own. He's a person who can lead the Israeli people. He's a person who can destroy Hamas. Okay, and when that is the case, right? When there are corruption charges and everything, so see, it's extremely safe to say that it's a diversion tactic. It is a diversion tactic, according to me at least. So, ceasefire is there. Ceasefire is a good option. A ceasefire does work out, but the complicated situation that is already very complicated. I mean, of course, a temporary ceasefire, but what measures one could take, etc., etc. A ceasefire would be very much plausible, but as I said, ulterior motives on the same, and Israel does not negotiate terms. And I have known this by the hijacking of the.
Yeah.
Yeah, the hijacking of the Israeli plane. Israel does
Exactly,
not
exactly.
negotiate with terrorists.
So you again, another good point added, that is the internal politics playing, you know, because Netanyahu, the reason why the public of Israel have lost so much trust in him is because of those corruption charges. And, you know, this very internal politics has resulted in him complicating an already complicated situation, which is why it's, and even, you know, if you look at the US standpoint of the conflict, you find more and more Democrats still advocating that US support Israel militarily. Primarily, again, a Jewish vote, a completely Jewish vote bank, because they simply want those votes so that they can win the elections. And on the other hand, they're preventing the US from holding someone accountable, right? And
yeah.
all these factors together just complicated the situation really further. And really, thank you so much for coming here. It's been great talking to you, and looking forward to hosting you once again later.
Okay, yeah, cool.
Guys, thank you a lot for listening to the podcast episode. Misha and I tried our best to ensure that we could give all the facts on the table, just put it right there. And, you know, we've tried to speak about how international law might affect the current conflict which has been taking place. Misha gave a good insight into diplomatic negotiations, how they go, and even as to the current questions regarding the US policy in Israel, Palestine. At the same time, how internal politics in both Israel and the US have been impacting the conflict and complicating it further. And we hope that you liked it. Like the podcast, share it with your family and friends, follow it as well. And also do check out the blog, which we've posted some really good content there. My recent post is on Yemen, as I said earlier. And really hope you comment there. And so thank you so much. Goodbye for now.